More certain than ever that she was tired, he offered her his chair.
No, please sit still. I think I will sit in the carriage.
Miss Honeychurch, you do sound tired.
Not a bit, said Lucy, with trembling lips.
But you are, and there's a look of George about you. And what were you saying about going abroad?
She was silent.
Greece?
And she saw that he was thinking the word over.
Greece? But you were to be married this year, I thought.
Not till January, it wasn't,
said Lucy, clasping her hands. Would she tell an actual lie when it came to the point?
I suppose that Mr. Vyse is going with you. It isn't because George spoke that you're both going.
No.
I hope that you will enjoy Greece with Mr. Vyse.
Thank you.
At that moment, Mr. Beebe came back from church. His cassock was covered with rain.
I counted on you two keeping each other company, he said kindly. It's pouring again. The entire congregation, which consists of your cousin, your mother, and my mother, stands waiting in the church till the carriage fetches it. Did you tell Mr. Emerson about Greece?
I did.
Don't you think it very plucky of her, Mr. Emerson, to undertake the two Miss Allens? Now, Miss Honeychurch, go back. Keep warm. I think three is such a courageous number to go travelling.
And he hurried off to the stables.
He's not going, she said hoarsely. I made a slip. Mr. Vyse does stop behind in England.
Somehow, it was impossible to cheat this old man. To George, to Cecil, she would have lied again, but he seemed so near the end of things, so dignified, that at whatever risk she told him that Cecil was not her companion to Greece. And she spoke so seriously that the risk became a certainty, and he, lifting his eyes, said,
"You're leaving the man you love?"
I had to.
Why, Miss Honeychurch? Why?
Terror came over her, and she lied again. She made the long, convincing speech that she had made to Mr. Beebe, and intended to make to the world when she announced that her engagement was no more. He heard her in silence, and then said,
"My dear, I am worried about you. It seems to me that you are in a muddle."
She shook her head.
"Take an old man's word. There's nothing worse than a muddle in all the world. It is easy to face death and fate and the things that sound so dreadful. It is on my muddles that I look back with horror, on the things that I might have avoided. Do you remember in that church when you pretended to be annoyed with me and weren't? Do you remember before when you refused the room with a view? Those were muddles. Little, but ominous, and I'm fearing that you are in one now."
She was silent.
"Don't trust me, Miss Honeychurch. Though life is very glorious, it is difficult."
She was still silent.
"Man has to pick up the use of his functions as he goes along, especially the function of love."
Then he burst out excitedly.
"That's it! That's what I mean. You love George."
But after his long preamble, the three words burst against Lucy like waves from the open sea.
"But you do," he went on, not waiting for contradiction. "You love the boy, body and soul, plainly, directly, as he loves you, and no other word expresses it. You won't marry the other man for his sake."
"How dare you!" gasped Lucy. "Oh, how like a man! I mean to suppose that a woman is always thinking about a man."
"But you are."
She summoned physical disgust.
"You're shocked, but I mean to shock you. I can reach you no other way. You must marry, or your life will be wasted. You've gone too far to retreat. I have no time for the tenderness and the comradeship and the poetry and the things that really matter and for which you marry. I know that with George you will find them, and that you love him. Then be his wife. He is already part of you. Though you fly to Greece and never see him again, or forget his very name, George will work in your thoughts till you die. It isn't possible to love and to part. You will wish that it was. You can transmute love, ignore it, muddle it, but you can never pull it out of you. I know by experience that the poets are right. Love is eternal.